W-T-E-N-E-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I am hugely honored to have Alexander with us from the YouTube channel, The Duran. If you haven't watched it, the link is in the description box for his channel in his name and also The Duran. But it's so important when the mainstream media is in lockstep, filling us with this baloney about how all the poorest countries in the world are military threats to America. So let's bomb the hell out of them and make millions for the likes of Bush and Cheney and all these political crime families. Well, Alexander, he's had massive success. I've been watching him constantly recently, exposing the truth behind all these wars, the pretext, why America is going in, the proxy wars, who's benefiting, the vested interests, and how Trump has come along and disrupted everything. But certainly in some unexpected ways, but it's given us a lot to talk about. And, you know, I was watching your interview just coming in from the park now with Dennis earlier, which was fantastic. Mm. And a huge thank you for coming on. And one of the things that was raised was if a country such as America is constantly looking for beasts to slay, it may become a beast itself. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, that's a quote from John Quincy Adams. Now, he was one of the founders of the United States. In other words, one of the people who wrote the Constitution of the United States just after he gained independence. And he was one of those people at that time. There was already tensions within the US. What kind of a country would it be? Would it become a great power? Would it start to assert itself around the world? And John Quincy Adams, who is, by the way, the same John Quincy Adams, who later became a brilliant lawyer and represented the slaves in the Amistad case. If some people have seen the film, that's the man who made that quote. Anyway, he said, look, we are here to try to establish a democracy, to try to become a republic. If we go out in the world and say to ourselves that we're going to do this in order to do good, in order to try to defeat evil, as we put it, around the world, then inevitably all that's going to happen is that we're going to become an empire, we're going to lose the republic, and we're going to become evil ourselves. Now, he didn't say it in those words, but he said that repeatedly many times, and that was his policy. It was his policy in the relatively short time that he was president of the United States himself, and he made that famous quote that America should not go out looking for monsters to slay, lest it become a monster itself.
And has America gone over the criteria for that? Have they slayed enough monsters to become a monster itself?
Well, they've been busy, and I think many people would say they've become pretty monstrous, and many people in America say that they've become pretty monstrous. And I mean, you talked about political crime families. Some of the people who run the United States, that is exactly what they are. And you see it passed down from generation to generation, and also whole groups of people congregate around this. American politics is very different in many ways from our own here in Britain. It's much more feudal, if I can say, put it like that, and much more clan-oriented than people understand. Because we speak the same language, we assume that we and they are like each other, and actually we're quite different in many things.
Yeah, I lived there for almost 20 years, and I love the American people.
Yeah.
But the people, the psychopaths, you know, who've got control of the power over there are absolutely terrifying. I've written extensively about the Clinton crime family and the Bushes. But another thing that struck
should quickly say, I believe that you coined the expression Clinton crime family. And it's been picked up and repeated to me so many times, including by many people in the US who are unaware of its provenance, just to say.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. So another thing that terrified me from your interview with Dennis is when you were discussing, you know, if Iran's nuclear infrastructure was bombed, the devastating consequences that would have on the rest of the world. Because I remember Chernobyl. And could you just expand on that, please?
Yeah, I mean, this is not, this is actually Dennis Kucinich. Now, just to explain who he is, he was for many, many years a representative, an MP, if you like, in the House of Representatives, which is the American equivalent of the House of Commons. He's a heroic individual. He took on organized crime in his own hometown, which is Cleveland. He was elected mayor of Cleveland. He was very successful mayor of Cleveland, and he had contracts taken out by people trying to kill him and all that kind of thing. But he fought on and got through. And eventually they elected him to Congress. And he's one of these people who very much believes in the original message of the United States as a republic. And he's always been opposed to all of these wars that we've been talking about. Anyway, he was specifically talking here about Iran. And he said that this whole program, supposedly, is to prevent Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. But the idea of bombing Iran into a point where it gives up nuclear weapons is simply not thought through. Because if you drop bombs on nuclear weapons facilities, all you're going to do is to go to disperse huge quantities of radioactive material across Iran, but potentially across much of the world, and you will create an ecological and potentially humanitarian catastrophe. Now, it's an appalling prospect, but there are people who are absolutely up for doing precisely that and who don't seem to care about the consequences.
Have you fathomed the mindset of these people? You know, you've got people saying we could have a nuclear war with Russia and America would win, etc. It just boggles my mind.
It's very difficult to say, have I understood these people? I've met some of them. I've had encounters with people like that. And what I would say about them is this. They are, again, this is Kucinich said this, they're drunk on power. The United States is the most powerful country in the world. It's been, you know, enormous military force. They can't believe that if America just uses its force, that there will be any real effect on the United States and on themselves. So they are absolutely drunk with this. And it's very difficult for them to think beyond it. And of course, the other thing is, this is where we come back to the point about becoming a monster. They, at some level, believe in all of this, too. They believe that might is right, that the United States is virtuous and good, and if it continues doing what it's doing, it'll bring peace and democracy to the world. And we mustn't let things like, you know, worries about nuclear contamination deter us from this noble cause.
Okay. Have you read the book, Guns, Germs and Steel?
No, I haven't.
No, okay, well, I have to read it. After reading that and you know, looking at the approximate 100-year world war cycle of recent centuries, you know, Hitler, Napoleon, etc., it seemed that every century there's a world war, but because of the advancements in technology, the casualties are greater. Do you think we would have a full nuclear war in this century? Do you think there's something in human nature that just drives us into self-destruct? I think Freud said we've got a death wish as well as having a wish to live.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Lots of people think this. Freud, as you said, thinks this. I refuse to be that pessimistic. I think we're human beings. We have the power of choice. We can choose not to go down this route. I think saying that our natures, our innate natures, drive us to wage war, I think that's an anti-humanist response, if I can put it like that. Now, I may be idealistic here, but that's what I want to believe. And in every situation where we are leading towards a war, we need to always remember that we do have that choice. I mean, we make the decision. Do we go to war or don't we? Do we end up in a world war situation or don't we? And there are always choices. And as human beings, we can insist that our leaders adopt particular choices.
But what about when we all marched against the war in Iraq and our leaders just ignored us?
Well, they did. We did march, and I marched, and I'm sure you marched, and lots of us did. And they did go to war, but it did have political consequences. Tony Blair ceased to be prime minister soon after. If all those people hadn't marched, he would remain prime minister. He would have led us into more things. Of that I'm absolutely sure. So one can't say that it made no difference. The problem is that we are not organized to maintain that kind of pressure all the time in the way that we should be. Now, I'm 64, if I could say. I can remember a time when there was a very powerful peace movement in Britain, where there was CND and other organizations like it, and people would come out in their millions and they'd protest against war and violence. That's what we need to get again. We've lost it somehow. We don't have it today.
So you are rather hopeful then, because, you know, when you've got the power in the hands of a group of people, I think it was Le Bon in the crowd said, the intelligence of the crowd goes to the lowest common denominator. When you've got all these people just reinforcing, you know, their own egos, like Hillary Clinton, we came, we saw, we killed him, etc. You get a glimpse into the mindset of these psychopaths. If they're all reinforcing that kind of mentality, it's terrifying for me. Having a baby, I'm thinking, could something like this happen this century?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, he was writing. He was creating this theory. I think it was the early 20th century that, I think it was the psychology of crowds and of masses of people, that what was very difficult to persuade one individual, you could actually manage to persuade lots of people brought together. You could manipulate them far more easily. I think that was probably true in his day. I mean, in fact, history suggests very much that it was true in his day. But things have progressed quite a lot since then. I think generally people are better educated today. I think there's a lot more information around. I think we have the internet. We have, dare I say it, shows like this and people like you. And you have a very, very wide reach. So it's not as easy for someone to achieve that level of manipulation that was true perhaps when he wrote that all those, a century plus ago. And as for hope, well, where are we without hope? If we have no hope and we despair, then the battle is already lost. So absolutely, I hold on to hope. And that gives me the courage to go on fighting and eventually to win.
Right, I'm going to show you a clip now and get your thoughts on it. We're going to go over to Dan Davies' channel. Let's see, where is it? Is it this one? I think it's this one. Major media misinformation. Sure. Yeah, this is it. All right. Have we got that on the screen? Mm-hmm. I do. Right. Let me make this big and I'll get your thoughts on it. Let's unmute.
Biden could have stopped it and Zelensky could have stopped it and Putin should have never started it. Everybody's to blame.
Have you spoken to President Zelensky, sir, about his offer to purchase more Patriot missile batteries?
Oh, I don't know. He's always looking to purchase missiles. You know, he's against. Listen, when you start a war, you got to know that you can win the war, right? You don't start a war against somebody that's 20 times your size and then hope that people give you some missiles.
That was President Trump just a few hours ago. Actually, that was made while we were on the air last.
You've done it. That. So what are your thoughts on that, Alexander?
Well, on Trump saying what he did. Well, I think he's right. Now, you know, I know a lot of people have very strong feelings about Donald Trump, and I can understand why completely, by the way. But on Ukraine, he is closer to being right than any other significant political figure in the West that I know. And he's absolutely right. I mean, first of all, this absolutely was an avoidable war. And I think that on that, I have no doubt about this. There were all kinds of things that should have been done and could have been done to prevent it. And the reason it happened, to say it frankly, was because I think some people greatly underestimated Russian resolve and Russian power and thought that if something went wrong in Ukraine, nonetheless, and in spite of that, we would be able to deal such a big blow to the Russians that the Russians would capitulate and break down and we'd have a change in Russia that was for the positive. I'm not saying, by the way, that the Russians themselves are guiltless in this matter, just to make that clear. But I think we did make very, very big miscalculations on our side and the war could have been avoided. And it was the biggest miscalculations of all were made in Ukraine, because Ukraine did have a pathway to peace. It's not ever talked about in our media, but there was an agreement made back in February 2015, the so-called Minsk Agreement, which set out a pathway for a political settlement, both of the conflicts within Ukraine and through settlement of those conflicts, ultimately of Ukraine's own tensions with Russia. And the Ukrainians took the decision that they weren't going to follow that because it required them to make certain concessions to political forces within their own country that they didn't want to make. So they chose a path of confrontation and it led to war, and it led to war with Russia, a far more powerful country than Ukraine. And as Trump absolutely rightly says, they should have taken that into account in advance and not listened to all the voices that pushed them in the direction that ultimately led to war. So Trump, I agree with him, actually.
So the only time I ever watch the BBC is when I visit my parents and I'm horrified by what I see. And I'm trying to explain to them that this mainstream narrative that Piers Morgan always pushes as well, that, you know, Russia just out of the blue invaded a nation and is the aggressor. There's no provocation. So just to go over some of the basics then, just to clarify things for the viewers, what is your opinion as to how this pecker-using piano-playing comedian got into power over there, and, you know, who was backing him?
Well, can I quickly say, before we get on to Zelensky, on that, on the Piers Morgan view of the events, the power that has, it's a very simple one. It reduces everything to a fight between good and evil, right and wrong, and all of that. Well, humanity, reality, history, politics is always much more complicated. And this is a particularly complex conflict, as conflicts usually are. So it's unhelpful to talk like this, which Piers Morgan does, but it's understandable why people who don't want to wrestle with all the complexities of all of this accept it. Now, As for Zelensky, how did he become president of Ukraine? Well, of course, he was originally a comedian. He was on television there. By the way, a good comedian. He was he's actually, just to say, a good actor, or at least he was. And he took over, he ran a political campaign in a country that was already not at peace. It was not in a full-scale war with Russia, but there was already a conflict in eastern Ukraine with Russian speakers, and it already had a very difficult and bad relationship with Russia. The economy was in a very, very bad condition. There was huge amounts of corruption. There was an enormous amount of political violence, and there were attempts to suppress use of the Russian language in parts of Ukraine. And of course, Zelensky himself comes from one of those parts of Ukraine, and his first language is Russian. So Zelensky said, vote for me and I will fix this. I will make peace. I will implement that Minsk agreement that we talked about. I will allow the use of Russian. I will sort out our relations with Russia. I will bring Ukraine back. So he fought the election as the peace candidate, and he won overwhelmingly. He got over 70% support. Now, as I said, this is a complicated story, probably because you can't just be a good person and stand in an election and win an election. He obviously had backers. Most people assume that those backers were certain very powerful business people in Ukraine. In Ukraine, as in Russia, business people are typically called oligarchs. And in Ukraine, that's probably true. There is no boundary in Ukrainian politics between business and politics. So they were bankrolling him. They had completely different agendas. And it's quite plausible that when they supported Zelensky and they made him president of Ukraine through this process, they never really intended that he would follow through with all of the things that he said he would do. And in fact, very, very quickly, he reversed his position and started doing exactly the opposite of the things that he said he would do. So instead of supporting use of Russian, he went ahead and continued to suppress it. Instead of saying he would implement the Minsk agreement, he reversed completely and said that the Minsk agreement is unworkable. He continued, in other words, the conflict, and it escalated into the war we have now.
And what was the role of America in that, helping him along, and the CIA?
Well, they did help him along, and they not only helped him along, but they weren't at all happy when he started to talk about peace in Ukraine and good relations with Russia. I mean, that's the other side of the story that we don't talk about very much in the West, because the West, and again, this isn't even really controversial now, the West always was pursuing a policy of trying to detach or draw Ukraine away from Russia, because the idea was that Ukraine used to be the second biggest republic in the Soviet Union after Russia itself. If you permanently divide Ukraine from Russia, then that makes Russia weaker and it prevents Russia from becoming a great power again. So the result was that we ended up, and I say we because Britain was also involved, we ended up backing all sorts of people in Ukraine who wanted conflict with Russia, and that also played a major role in bringing about the war.
So why are the Europeans so gung-ho to keep it going against the will of Trump?
Well, that is an excellent question. And I have to say, it doesn't surprise me. But of course, the Europeans also had a very strong interest in promoting this movement in Ukraine. I should make it clear, by the way, there were also people in Ukraine who also wanted to distance Ukraine from Russia for all kinds of reasons. I mean, they had a more Western conception of the future of Ukraine. And that was part of the internal crisis within Ukraine, because a lot of other people in Ukraine, maybe the majority of people in Ukraine, preferred a closer relationship with Russia. But anyway, the Europeans wanted to support this movement in Ukraine. I suspect ultimately for the same reason, that they too don't want Russia to become too strong. Because if Russia were to develop strong ties with Ukraine and Belarus and all of these countries and became a superpower, or at least a great power again, it would be a great power on the EU's Western, the European Union's Western, Eastern border. And that might prevent further processes towards eastward expansion of the EU. But it might also create countervailing pressures in Eastern Europe. So countries like Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, which historically had fairly close relations with Russia, might start getting being drawn back into the sort of Russian orbit, if I can say put it like that, and the EU itself might start to fracture. So I think there was that. I think that has always been there. It was unnecessary concern, in my opinion, because I don't think the Russians have ever wanted to break up the EU or anything like that. In fact, I can remember a time, 15 years ago, when Russia wanted to join the EU. but that, of course, was never acceptable because it was too big.
All right, viewers, I'm here with Alexander from the Duran, and his links are in the description box, and I will put them in the live chat. Please subscribe. He's doing really important work. And if you've got any questions, put them in the chat. One of the themes that I was going to ask you about, and someone is asking about it in the chat, is the quarter trillion in assets frozen, the Russian assets, and kind of like the financial incentives here. We had Alex Craner on, and he was talking about the minerals. And I remember when, Cheney and Halliburton were in Iraq, and if a soldier picked up a banana in the canteen, the taxpayers were billed like $50 for a banana. Who are the vested interests profiting from Ukraine and all this frozen money, the quarter trillion in Russian, who's going to end up putting that in their pockets?
Well, that's an excellent question, because, of course, the quarter trillion is mostly in a very interesting organization called Euroclear. Euroclear is a public company based in Belgium, and it acts as a depository for money owned by central banks, mostly. Not just central banks, but some other entities. But anyway, it is in Euroclear, and it accrues interest there. Just as if you put your money in a savings account and you get interest on it, Euroclear pays interest on assets that you hold in Euroclear. So that interest technically is Russian money. Now, what has been happening is that through some very complicated legal jiggery, which I don't myself understand and don't believe in, by the way, I think it's nonsense. But anyway, they've been helping themselves to the interest. And when I say they, the Europeans have been helping themselves to the interest. And they've been using that increasing. They're starting to use it to buy weapons. So the weapons companies will get some of that money. They've also been giving a lot of that money to Ukraine, or starting to give a lot of that money to Ukraine. They're doing it in a very cunning way. They're giving Ukraine loans, 50 billion euro loan. And Ukraine is going to repay that loan out of the interest that Russia makes in Euroclear. That sounds absurd and complicated, and frankly dishonest it is. But anyway, that's the idea. So Ukraine, in theory, benefits. But of course, any money that goes to Ukraine goes straight out again, because Ukraine has to buy things in the West, and that goes back to the West, and buys things. It buys all kinds of equipment. It buys weapons. It buys all sorts of things. And of course, Ukraine is the most corrupt country in Europe, so some of that money goes straight into bank accounts in, the Caribbean, the Isle of Man, no doubt, and all of those places. And, of course, the people who run those banks ultimately they do quite well out of it as well, as do the lawyers and the accountants and all of those people. So quite a lot of people do very well out of this. One shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that there are no beneficiaries. There are lots of beneficiaries, and all sorts of lawyers have already been instructed to explain how this can be done in a legal way, which you can't, by the way. I can tell you that now. But you can always find lawyers who will tell you that you can do something which is fundamentally dishonest, and you can find ways legally to do it. And of course, there have been law firms that have done that, and they've done very well from this too. So a lot of people have done very well out of that. And it's, for the moment, the golden goose, the goose that continues to lay the golden eggs.
Wow, that is mind-blowing just to think of that amount of interest. Mm. And the Pekka piano player, he's got to trade his weapons for his kilos of Pablo Escobar powder as well. So you expressed concern, Alexander, when Keir Starmer was over there slobbering all over Biden, trying to get him to fire the long-range missiles into Russia. And then, you know, just before there was the transfer, the Biden administration went and did it anyway. And then I think in recent weeks, there came out, there were some scenarios that were run by American intelligence, whereby they had a 50% risk of escalation leading to nuclear war. Why do you think they would take it to the brink like that?
Well, this is an excellent question. And I think it's a question we should all be asking. I mean, those of us who have time to meet our MPs, I don't, by the way, but those of us who do, should be asking our MPs about this. We should be really concerned that our government is prepared to take these incredible risks, 50% risk of an escalation that could lead to a nuclear exchange with the country, Russia, which has more nuclear weapons than any other country, and lots of missiles and full capability to launch those weapons and to basically have been. Well, I mean, we don't even want to talk about what that might come to. So why do we do this? Why do we do this all the time? Well, at some point, we, and I say we, the British government, and I don't just mean Starmer, but, you know, the entire British governing government system, Conservative, Labour, people in the Ministry of Defence, all of those, they became committed to this war. It's become their war.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
If you read an article in the Times that was published a few days ago, it describes how deeply involved our own military has been in this war. Our own commanders, our own strategists, our own intelligence people. So it's a war that they are fighting already against Russia. And it's a war that they're losing, or at least they feel they're losing, because Ukraine is losing the war. So in that situation, when you sense that you are losing, you're going to try and find some way to turn the situation round and to achieve a victory. And that inevitably propels you into taking risks and starting a pattern of escalation. And that's what they've been doing. The terrible thing here is that they've never admitted to us, the people of Britain, what they've actually been up to. If we'd known that we were so heavily involved in this war, if British people had known, maybe we'd have said something about it.
So is Trump the peace president? I think it was Salente we had on, who said, you know, because Ukraine is a losing proposition, the money's got to be spent and it's just getting moved over to Iran. The military industrial complex must be fed and the president doesn't have any control over that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think he's the peace president in the sense that he wants to get the United States out of the war in Ukraine. I don't know that he's the peace president in any other respect. I mean, he's absolutely committed, it seems to me, into some kind of big confrontation with China. Perhaps he doesn't want a war with China. He's a businessman, so he probably has some idea of the risks. But all the rhetoric, all the discussion, all the analysis that you go to, again, the American media, they produce reams of analysis. There's all these think tanks and, you know, NGOs in the US that do nothing else than think and plan and discuss what to do. And they're all talking about war with China now. And they've been saying increasingly that we can't fight this war with China because China's getting too strong. We need all our forces in Europe to be transferred to the Pacific so that we can take on the Chinese in perhaps more equal terms or even surpass them. We don't have huge amounts of time. So I think there is an awful lot of that going on. And whether this is quite Trump's idea, I'm not sure. But certainly there are a lot of other people in his own administration who do think in these terms. They see the future as war with China and they don't want to waste more time on this losing war in Ukraine, which isn't so interesting to them. And of course, is Trump the peace president in the Middle East? I've seen no sign of it there so far. Again, he talks about peace. He talks about negotiations with Iran, even at the same time as he is talking about bombing Iran. And, well, in Gaza, well, it just goes from bad to worse every day, as far as I can see.
There's a comment here, and I'll just see if I can get you to comment on it. NATO corrupted by Biden and EU, Ukraine corrupted by Zelensky, but that does not make Russia's right to invade a sovereign country. Russia invading is totally unacceptable.
Well, maybe it is. I'm not here to defend what the Russians did. You could take that line. But Russia perceived that it had certain security interests. And it was worried that Ukraine was going to join NATO. And Tony Blinken, who is the US Secretary of State, just before the war began, and now this is not even disputed, said to the Russians, well, if Ukraine joins NATO, we consider ourselves fully entitled to install ballistic missiles there, which will be able to reach Moscow in about 3 minutes. So, you know, maybe you can argue that what the Russians did was unacceptable, that what the Russians did was wrong. But the point is, faced by that threat, which maybe we weren't intending to threaten them, but they might have believed that they were being threatened. Faced by what they believed to be that threat, was it or was it not likely that they would act as they did? I think it was very likely that they would act as they did. And that, in fact, is precisely why they did act as they did. I think we need to get away from saying this was right and this was wrong on the Russian side and even on us, and be realistic about how countries and people and political leaders respond in these sort of situations.
Yeah, that was a really good answer, because there is a narrative out there, another one perpetuated by Piers Morgan, that if you do give a response to a comment like this that's steeped in research and realistic history, then you're a Putin repeater, you're pro-Russia and all this. But the fact is, our hearts go out to the people of Ukraine who've been blood sacrificed by these vested interests, turning the country into a proxy war. It's absolutely disgusting. And, you know, what Dennis pointed out earlier is going on in Palestine with these bombs just dropping and mass incinerating women and kids in particular, perhaps taking a leaf out of the war on terror launched by Bush and Blair, which the BBC said they estimate over 5 million people have died from the war on terror, and more than half of them women and kids, dropping bombs on the poorest countries in the world. So do you think then that world war is more likely to come out of the Middle East or out of Ukraine, Russia?
Right. Well, before I address that, just to go back to the sort of Piers Morgan argument about repeating Russian talking points, which you hear all the time. You have to at least listen to what the Russians are saying, or you're going to end up in a massive conflict. And your point is absolutely the right one. How has our policy, what we have been doing, in the end, helped Ukraine? It hasn't. It has destroyed Ukraine. It has caused tens of thousands of people in Ukraine to die. When Trump says that, you know, it's been propelled into a war with a country 20 times more powerful, he is absolutely right. So the point, the policy should have been to avoid war. And if that meant that, yes, you made some concessions to the Russians, for example, about the use of the Russian language inside Ukraine, and should have agreed that Ukraine wouldn't join NATO, which is, by the way, what you did agree to previously. If that had avoided a war, well, go do it. The point is, we didn't do it. We did the opposite. And we can't say as a result that we don't share our, we don't have our own share of responsibility for the situation that has developed there. Now, as to where World War III is more likely to start, the Middle East or Ukraine, I would say now without hesitation, the Middle East. I think we are past the most dangerous period in Ukraine. The most dangerous period was last year when the Russians began their offensive and we had this idea of launching missiles into Russia, and all kinds of things looked like they were going to get out of control. I don't think that Trump is looking for World War III with Russia, and I don't think we're going to see that happen. I think one way or the other, the conflict in Ukraine is now in its last stages. I mean, there may be a lot of fighting, a lot of killing, a lot of horror and misery and pain, but the great risk of World War III has been averted. In the Middle East, one can't say that. On the contrary, it looks to me as if the situation in the Middle East is becoming more and more dangerous every day.
What are the sequence of events that could lead to world war? For example, would it be America attacks Iran, Israel joins in, Iran attacks Israel, and then, you know, the oil gets cut off to China, as one person's pointing out, so China and Russia come in. How do you see it unfolding?
Well, okay, can I just turn to that last point, because it's an absolutely valid one. I mean, there is a view. Again, I'm not able to say how valid it is, but I suspect that it is very valid, that one of the reasons for this interest in Iran is precisely because, as of today, Iran is one of China's most important oil suppliers. And the United States is in this conflict with China, and it's trying to stop all Iranian oil exports and hoping that if it can do that, that will put the situation of China in a very difficult one. Nonetheless, I'm going to say this. I think the Chinese can source their oil from other places. They can buy it from Saudi Arabia. They can buy it from Russia. They're increasing their oil purchases from Russia. So I think that is probably not the great danger. My own view is that the way this could get into World War III, bring us into World War III, is this. The US attacks Iran. Iran decides over the course of this attack, which could be a prolonged one, that it is going to go nuclear. It has a significant nuclear stockpile. It then explodes its own atomic device. That then leads to escalation from our side, in which nuclear weapons are used. And then when nuclear weapons start being used, perhaps especially if the Iranians have still the capability to respond, then the whole thing spirals and escalates out of control. And at that point, the other great powers, China and Russia, become involved. That would be that is not, unfortunately, an implausible scenario. And the Iranians have said that if they are attacked, they will withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a very, very strong hint that they would, in that case, decide to go for nuclear weapons.
And that seems to tie in to this world war cycle that happens every century, whereby the biggest power is trying to get more and more aggressive, and then the next biggest ones ally to put the big one in check, like we did with Hitler, like what happened to Napoleon. So it would just be playing out again and again and again. But now we've got nuclear weapons. There could be a completely different outcome, the complete destruction of the entire world. Where would Israel be at this point?
Well, Israel, I would have thought, ought to want a situation where war with Iran is avoided. Because if we have a nuclear war, then, I mean, Iran might conceivably survive a nuclear war. It's a very big country, 85, 90 million people, very large country, very mountainous. Many people would survive. Israel is a very small country territorially. And if it becomes involved in a nuclear exchange, realistically, it's not going to survive. And yet the reality is that despite that, Israel seems to be still pushing for some kind of confrontation with Iran. They will say it's to prevent Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. I think it's more likely to persuade Iran to acquire nuclear weapons. And what you were saying about this is exactly the kind of scenario that we saw at the start of the two world wars, especially, by the way, the first one. You are absolutely right. That is exactly what happened. You had a situation where one great power, Austria, attacked a small country, Serbia, and then the other great powers became involved. Germany got drawn in, France and Russia then got drawn in, Britain then got drawn in, and then before anybody knew, we had a world war, and that eventually extended to China, Japan, the United States. They all became pulled into the First World War. That's exactly that kind of scenario, and we should be working hard to avoid it. And it ought to be possible, because the Iranians say they don't want nuclear weapons, and the Americans say they don't want the Iranians to have nuclear weapons. So on the face of it, they both agree. So why a conflict at all? I mean, they both agree about the objective. The only question, therefore, logically, is how to structure it so as to come to a satisfactory resolution which preserves the interests of both. It should not be difficult.
Aren't Zelensky and Netanyahu both in the unique position of the careers hinge on continued war?
Well, I'm afraid that is true. I'm afraid it's true of both of them. I mean, in Netanyahu's case, I should say that it appears that there is an intellectual belief on his side that war is the way to secure Israel's future. I should say that his father was the secretary of a man called Jabotinsky, who was one of the creators, one of the people who was there at the creation of Israel. Now, he was a very angry man, very understandably. This is the period just after the Nazi Holocaust, so you can understand why he was angry. But his attitude was that Israel must take an absolutely unflinching position. It was never compromised. All its opponents should be treated as enemies and they should be defeated. And that does seem to be Netanyahu's view, that the path to security for Israel is victory. Now, I don't think that kind of victory is achievable. And I think trying to pursue it leads Israel into endless wars, which are dangerous for itself. But he seems to have become the follower of that of that doctrine.
Viewers, I think I've hogged Alexander enough for now. I'll start to give him your questions. If you've got any more questions, keep sending them in. I've got them all backed up here. So Tracy wants to know, what country would Iran bomb first?
Oh, that's, well, Israel, presumably. I mean, if we're talking about nuclear weapons, I mean, that is the obvious target. I can't see what other target they would bomb. I don't think they would do that as the first step. I mean, the first step, presumably, would be to close the Gulf of Hormuz. In other words, to close the Persian Gulf to protect, prevent oil tankers from exiting, which would itself create a global economic crisis, by the way.
Nicholas, why does Israel have so much influence over the USA?
That is an excellent question. And I'm afraid this is the area where you've got to be particularly careful, because all sorts of people come up with all kinds of theories, which I am sorry to say sometimes lead people, it seems to me, down rabbit holes. There is no doubt at all that the Jewish community, parts of the Jewish community in the United States, are very committed to Israel. And that's unsurprising. It is also true that parts of the Jewish community are extremely influential in American political life, and also in media and in television and cinema and that kind of thing. But my own personal view is that to focus entirely on the Jewish community is to mistake this. I think that what happened was that way back in the 1960s, the United States turned to Israel as its major ally in the Middle East at a time when it was involved in a conflict in the Middle East over influence with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was gaining a lot of influence in the Middle East at that time. And I think that created a very, very strong alliance between Israel, parts of the American military, and the foreign policy apparatus, and also, of course, the American arms industries. And the arms industries are very important in the United States, because not only do they provide a lot of the campaign funding, but they also fund all these think tanks, all these places that come up with all this analysis and discussion that I talk about, what I talked about earlier. And they play, therefore, a very big role in shaping U.S. foreign policy. So it's a coalition of people, the Jewish community, the military-industrial complex, the army, parts of the State Department, and also, and this is undoubtedly true, parts of the evangelical Christian community, which is very big in the United States, and which has convinced itself that Israel, that, you know, Israel is something that ought to be defended as part of their own religious beliefs.
Yeah, there's a lot of people saying the tail's wagging the dog, but hasn't America just converted Israel into a military outpost in a hugely significant geopolitical region? And it, without, you know, the weapons, the enabling, Israel wouldn't be able to do the things that people are criticizing it for. So really, it's just America's proxy.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm going to say something else. I think it's been an absolute disaster for Israel, by the way. I think that if Israel had not had that level of support from the United States, by now it would have made peace. It's the fact that it has had the backing of the United States, the unqualified backing of the United States, which explains why instead it has pursued victory instead of peace. And I think victory is unachievable. But in the process, I think it has led Israel down a moral dark hole, which I don't want to talk about too much. We've all seen what's been going on in Gaza and those sort of places. It's led to rampant militarization within Israeli society. It's completely changed in the worst way the level of public debate there, and it's made Israel what it is now. And I think without that American support, exactly as you say, it would have been a completely different country.
Yeah, there's good and bad in every country, and it's a shame that all the Jewish people take heat because of the actions of the psychopaths that rise to the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, Blair and Bush, War on Terror, they killed 100 times more people dropping bombs on the poorest countries of the world than Israel's done now. It's
absolutely
all
true. That's
horrific
absolutely
and
true,
disgusting.
By the way. Yeah. That's not in any way to excuse what, you know, what's happening in Gaza. But then we are complicit in that too. So, you know, you can't just say that it's, you know, people in Israel or, supporters of Israel elsewhere, because we are facilitating this as part of our own strategies in the Middle East, which remain, in my opinion, all about preserving our own dominance in that region. I say our dominance because whatever interests our country thinks it has in the Middle East, I'm not sure what they are, by the way. But, I mean, we do seem to be very keen to protect them, and we've aligned ourselves with the United States. And the United States is not only active in making all this possible, but it wouldn't be possible without the United States. Ultimately, that is where the ultimate responsibility for this disaster lies. And I'm not anti-American at all. May I say that very clearly? I mean, I'm not. It seems like we're beating up a lot on the United States at the moment. On the contrary, I'm somebody who is often spoken about as being altogether too pro-American.
We're beating up on the psychopathic leaders and warmongers.
Exactly, exactly.
Did you watch Douglas Murray on Joe Rogan recently? I think it was with Dave Smith. And when Dave is just using common sense against him, talking about, you know, all of the deaths in Palestine and how horrific it is, and how he's seeing these pictures of babies and children just trapped and left to die and all this stuff. And Douglas, his standard responses are that, well, 2 out of 3 houses, and I'm just paraphrasing here, I can't remember the exact specifics. It was something like 2 or 3 houses in Palestine either have weapons for Hamas or tunnels for Hamas. So, you know, what's Israel supposed to do? It's fighting a war, and they've just got to go ahead and bomb all these places. What kind of response would you give to that?
Well, I would simply say that that's been the response that Israel has pursued for decades. Some would say since its founding, but certainly, in my opinion, since the 80s, 1980s, at the very least. And where has it led? It's led to endless war, endless violence, tens of thousands of people killed, children killed. It's not provided peace for Israel. Israel's economy is apparently now under immense stress. People are leaving Israel because they are afraid. So it is absolutely the wrong policy. I think that you should seek peace. And can I say, if we're talking about Hamas, and may I stress, I do not like Hamas as it happens. I mean, I want to make that very clear. But if we're talking about Hamas, Hamas is not only a creation of this kind of horror that has been created all over these decades, but there is now a certain amount of evidence, a convincing amount of evidence, that its rise was at the very least facilitated by some people within the Israeli government who were trying to use it to undermine more secular nationalist forces in amongst the Palestinians, who I think they thought would be more attractive to people in the West than Hamas would ever be. So what Douglas Murray is saying, far from being a, you know, argument, a compelling argument, it simply confirms that the Israeli government has locked Israel into a kind of indefinite hole from which it never can escape. That's what I would say.
Yeah, it seems like an excuse for perpetual Orwellian war. And he's saying that to wipe out the terrorists, you just got to kill all these people. Well, if the Chinese were here bombing my house and my family members' remains are all splattered all over the wall and I survive, you know, I'm not a terrorist, but I'm sure as hell at that moment going to want to go and do something back to the Chinese. They're just creating more enemies.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're perfectly correct. You are entirely right. I should say that, you know, if you follow wars of resistance, you find this pattern constantly repeat itself.
You're getting asked about Keir Starmer offering to send British troops to Ukraine. I mean, there's not any young people left in Ukraine to fight, is there? They're snatching kids off the street. I've seen, watched some videos.
Pretty much. And reports today that they tried to persuade young people in Ukraine to join the army, and apparently only 500 people did, which and that came from Zelensky's own office. So it looks like it must be true. It doesn't look like it's something that somebody has made up. As to why our prime minister wants to send British soldiers to Ukraine, I am completely at a loss to understand this. Whether he thinks this is making him important, whether he believes in this cause in some way, whether it's a distraction, what exactly he thinks he's doing, I really don't know. But it's an incredibly bad idea. Anybody who's looked at this properly can see that it is. And I just am amazed that within his own government, people are not taking him aside and telling him this is an incredibly bad idea. Let's stop.
Yes, let's stop indeed. But it's just perpetual, isn't it? All right, so the next question is from Seago. Is nuclear war actually feasible? If the world becomes a nuclear fallout hellhole, what's left for the uber-rich plankton of the world to reign supreme over? I mean, they've got these bunkers and stuff, but they're not going to survive a nuclear winter. No. Are they coming out of them?
No, that's absolutely correct. And I mean, nuclear war is ultimately irrational. I mean, it's mad. There was that, when I say, I use the word mad, intentionally, because that was the doctrine that the United States came up with in the 1960s. Mutual assured destruction. Mad. It is mad. It's madness to think about nuclear war. But one of the most frightening things for me over the last 3 years is the really shocking revelation that an awful lot of people in decision-making positions no longer fear nuclear war. They constantly say, well, we won't get really into a nuclear war situation because the Russians are only bluffing and Putin is only bluffing, and therefore we can go on and do whatever we want and be as aggressive as we want and as confrontational as we want, because ultimately it's just all a bluff. It's the kind of sentiment that got us into the war in Ukraine in the first place. It's the reason why we have a war, and people don't seem to realize again how incredibly dangerous that is. The question, just to go back to the question, the question is absolutely right. I mean, a nuclear war makes absolutely no sense. Do the people who are ruling us at the moment strike you as sensible people? Just saying.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Russia with war makes absolutely no sense. You know, Piers Morgan's calling Putin Hitler, but it's actually a Hitlerian strategy to fight Russia. Napoleon, haven't they learned the lessons from these people?
Well, quite. That's a very good point as well. But I mean, again, this constant resurrection of Hitler all the time, and the way in which he's used and conjured up. So every single conflict involves, we're always fighting Hitler. So Hitler didn't die in the bunker in Berlin in 1945. You know, he moved to Baghdad and he became Saddam Hussein, and then he moved to Tripoli and he became Muammar Gaddafi, and now he's moved to Moscow and he's Vladimir Putin. This is incredibly unhelpful. I mean, we need to put that all behind us. Obviously, it's an important part of our history and our story as a nation, but we shouldn't just imagine that the same story repeats itself again and again. I sometimes get the sense that people like Piers Morgan are living inside a historical novel. They imagine that, you know, they're not, either they're Churchill or that, you know, that there's, you know, I don't know, somebody else there, Brendan Bracken, the journalist of that period. And they're just reenacting constantly the, you know, what they read inside that novel. You know, the historical novel, you know, of events 1937 to 41. And of course, that isn't a guide to the problems of today.
Well, I'm having deja vu with Iran now, because I'm hearing again, Iran's got weapons of mass destruction. I'm seeing the same discussions as exactly with Iraq. And it just seems it never ends. If you go back to Julius Caesar, when he wanted to conquer us for the, you know, rumors of precious pearls and the tin and the resources, he told the locals that we were a military threat, even though he knew we were going around in chariots, which are outdated, and warring tribes, and, you know, that we weren't a military threat at all. So did they just think we're completely dumb and they can use this military threat excuse forever with us?
Yeah, I think they do, actually, at some level. I think they do. I think that, I mean, having been close to politicians, politicians have a very strange attitude, especially in democracies, towards their voters. On the one hand, they're a bit scared of them, and it's a fact. On the other hand, they have a very patronizing view of them, mostly. The number of politicians who actually like their voters is surprisingly small, just to say. So I mean, that wasn't always the case in politics, but I think it is very, very much the case now. So yes, they do think that they, you know, they can manipulate and they can spin stories and narratives and people will buy it and that kind of thing. But the thing to also remember about politicians is that they're not particularly bright. There's a political class. They are, in fact, surprisingly not so. And they themselves very often believe many of the fairy tales they're telling us or come to. I mean, they read, one of the things people don't realize about politicians, and I'm talking about ministers, is that they get most of their ideas from what they read in the newspapers. It sounds astonishing, but on foreign policy, especially, it's true.
Wow. And it's the sanctimonious psychopath that's one of the most dangerous. So a question from Ray J. Is Trump any strong? Is Rubio being held in check because he's a neocon? Why an independent negotiator in Wyckoff?
Well, actually, you've asked an excellent question. And you've provided your own answer in a kind of a way. Why Wyckoff? Why is Wyckoff there? Well, it's obvious because Trump doesn't trust anyone else. He doesn't trust Rubio. He doesn't trust Waltz, his national security advisor. He doesn't trust Kellogg, who is his peace envoy. He doesn't trust any of these people. So he has to work with them because they're part of the US establishment. But he's reached out to his friend, his old friend, who's clearly a very clever man, by the way, Steve Wyckoff, who is a man who made an awful lot of money in New York real estate. And he's clearly the person who is conducting the actual foreign policy of the United States. Yes, Rubio is a neocon. At least that was his past. He's shown some signs occasionally of thinking beyond that. Mike Waltz, also a neocon, and I have to say a more rigid one than Rubio is. Rubio is a bit too intelligent to be completely rigid. Kellogg, 80-year-old general, he is a neocon. He's too old to change, one suspects. So Trump relies on Wyckoff. And Witkoff is doing everything. He's talking to the Russians. He's talking to the Israelis. He's talking to the Iranians. And he's doing it without much backup. He doesn't have a big team because he's not in the State Department or the National Security Council. And he's trying to do too much all at the same time. And you can see the problems.
Are we ever going to get rid of these pesky neocons, Alexander?
Well, the thing to say about the neocons in America, this is where, you know, we talk about the good side of America. They are not popular. If you spend any time in America, if you spend time with Americans, you discover very, very quickly that they're as disillusioned and as hostile to all of these policies as people everywhere else. This isn't a popular line in America. And the reason why Trump won the election in November was partly because he is opposed to these people. So in theory, yes, maybe one day we will get rid of them, but it will be extremely difficult to do. They are very strongly embedded in the American political system and in the bureaucracy and in the media. And prizing them out of the positions they have is going to take a very long time, and it's going to be a very, very tough battle.
And we'll have to burn all the books written by Kissinger and Zabrinsky. Yeah. So in conclusion, Alexander, you said you have a more positive outlook on things, and it's been quite dark for this past hour, the things that we've discussed. So what's the best case scenario coming out of the Middle East? Is it that Trump is just posturing and just you know, pretending that he's going to go to war by saying these really threatening things to Iran to get them just to bow down and cut some kind of deal?
I think the positive thing is that I don't think that Donald Trump wants a war in the Middle East. I think he's not a leader who spends hours of time looking at all the graphs and all the tables and thinking about what the implications of the war are. But I think instinctively, he senses that it would be a disaster and that it would end his presidency. Probably he doesn't think beyond that. But I think he doesn't want a war in the Middle East. He wants to do a deal. He always talks about deals. He wants to do a deal with Iran. And I come back to what I said. The Iranians say they don't want nuclear weapons. And I believe them. I think it'd be dangerous for them to have nuclear weapons. They don't want an arms race in the Middle East. The United States says it doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. So they are agreed on the objective. All they need to do is to work out the process. And that may be difficult, but it shouldn't be impossible. So if I'm right, and Trump doesn't want a war in the Middle East, and the Iranians, I am sure, do not want a war in the Middle East, because a war in the Middle East would be a disaster for their country, however it turns out, then logically, all the pieces are in place so that we get eventually a deal done between the United States and Iran, and that would be a stabilizing factor in the Middle East. But to solve the problem of the Middle East, to bring peace there, you have to finally address the underlying conflict, the main conflict, which is the one between the Arabs, the Palestinians, and the Israelis. That is going to be a very difficult conflict to sort out. That may take a very long time. It's taken all my lifetime. But the conflict with Iran ought to be solvable.
I think you're probably right, because the oil price in the commodities market is definitely not pricing in a war. It's remaining pretty low. And just a question that ties into that then, are the tariffs that have rocked the financial markets recently, are they bluster as well, so Trump can just cut more deals?
Well, I think a lot of people think that. I believe that he believes in tariffs. Now, I'm not going to say whether tariffs are going to be a good thing or a bad thing in the long run for the United States, but he's persuaded himself that America has to be a big industrial manufacturing power again. He thinks that because he cares. I think he does care about industrial communities in the United States. he gets a lot of his electoral support for them. But also for Trump, I think it's also a question of power. He believes that America has to have a big industrial base and lots of manufacturing and workers and all of that so that he can go head to head with China over the long term. So he thinks tariffs are the way to do it. And I think we are going to have some tariffs going forward, at least while Trump is president. I don't think he's ever going to do away with tariffs entirely. But I think he will want to cut some deals wherever he can, even with China. And tariffs with China are insanely high. There is no trade now going on between the US and China to any real degree. And that's going to create more and more problems economically in the US, China too, but even more, I think, in the US. And at some point, he's got to cut a deal with the Chinese and start to get those tariffs down to more manageable levels. Whether he'll do it is, of course, another matter, because he's Donald Trump. He does things in a most extraordinary way. He's very unconventional. He does things in ways that nobody else would do. And sometimes that works, and very often it doesn't. But anyway, we'll see what he manages.
I'll do a quick poll before you go. So viewers, please put a one in the chat if you would like to see Alexander back on the channel, if but for his extremely soothing broadcasting voice. I mean, this has gone so fast for me, and I just there's some quality about your voice. I can't explain it. I just love to listen to. Put a two in the chat if you'd like Alexander to bog off and never come back. Well, I know it's all ones coming in, so that's great. Thank you, folks. Alexander's channel links. You've got the main channel, the Duran, and you've got his own channel. The links are in the description box. There's tons more content over there. He's hammering it out every day. What can the viewers look forward to on your channel in the coming weeks, Alexander? What guests have you got lined up or anything?
What guests will we have? Well, we have various people, actually. We got a big top expert about China, who is actually one of our major academics about China. We're having more people from the military. Some of the people in the military are very, very unhappy about some of the things that are going on. Quite possibly we'll be having Dan Davis, who you showed there briefly, who I should say I consider a personal friend. There'll be other people, but I don't want to give away too much because that would be jumping ahead, if I could say. But anyway, can I just say it's been an absolute privilege being on this show. I love this show altogether. It's wonderful to be able to be here and just to say thanks for that and to all the wonderful people who've asked actually these really good questions, if I could say.
Oh, thank you, my friend. You're welcome back anytime. And good luck with Dan. And I wish you continued success and you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alexander. Cheers. What a phenomenal guest, folks. And thank you for all of your questions. I'll have a look at what's coming up for the rest of the week. So last night we had Maggie Oliver on with Amber from the BBC's drama The Three Girls about the grooming gangs. She was a survivor and she came on and did an interview for the first time. She spoke out. Well, Maggie Oliver, the cop who blew the whistle on the grooming gangs in Rochdale, she's coming back for a 2-hour panel tomorrow with two survivors. We've got Gemma and we've got Kate Alicia. So that's from 6 until 8. And then we have got another 2 hours after that, and that's with Graham Moore. He's a constitutionalist. He's going to be talking about the grooming gang and illegal immigration explosion and who profits. The amount of money companies like Serco are making from housing unfettered immigration, even if they get incarcerated, the amount of money that they're making, it's up there with the interest on the quarter trillion of Russian assets that Alexander just told us about. And then we've got two young researchers coming on at 5 o'clock, from 5 to 6, talking about the Mercy Corps scandal, which involves everything from the Freemasons to US aid. And I'd never heard of it until I was approached by Elliot and Patrick. So we've got a good 5 hours of content. that I'm going to be doing personally. And then Ron's got his shows coming in as well. Ron's got a few ex-cops that he's talking to. And I know he's got an ex-police staffer coming on. This is on April the 17th at 7 p.m. Her name is Izzy Vine. She's never been on the channel before. I think she's working with the London Met. And she's going to be talking about the shocking realities that she encountered when she was working for the London Met. And he's got a U.S. Ex-cop. And he's also got another U.K. cop that he's got lined up to come on. So wherever you are in the world watching this, I appreciate you tuning in and asking such great questions, like Alexander said. And we will be back tomorrow it's going to be a huge day. A huge day and night tomorrow of all the content we've got. Thanks for tuning in and supporting Amber last night when she came on with Maggie Oliver voice and this.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.